Okay, a Freilich in Chanukah, Rabbi Yisai, and a good Tavach. I think that it's appropriate to dedicate today's shiur to Chanukah. In order to remain loyal to our official subject matter, I'll say that we may say that this is actually a certain recap of much of what Chodesh Halvavos is all about, which would really be true for any of the Yomim Tovim, because Chodesh Halvavos really is the heart of what all of our Yiddishkeit should be revolving around. But let's talk about Chanukah a little bit. There is an amazing book / sefer called, in Hebrew it's called Yishael Yehudi. I think that in English it's called also To Remain a Jew. I think that's what it's called. About a remarkable Jew by the name of Rabbi Yitzchok Zilber. Rabbi Yitzchok Zilber was a legendary name among Jews who came to Eretz Yisrael from Russia. He was a person who had made that journey, and he was nifter some, probably about, 17 years ago. It was shortly after we moved to Ramat Beit Shemesh. Probably regarded as the gadol of Russian Jewry in Eretz Yisrael. What was so remarkable about this Rabbi Yitzchok Zilber was how under communist rule, and this is something that you'll hear about many, but I'm using him as an example, how under communist rule, he maintained a rigorous life of Shmiras Torah Mitzvahs, not just in a general way, but perhaps I'll give a couple of examples, but down to the fine details of Halacha, and raised a family of Bnei Torah in communist Russia. I'll just give one example, a couple of examples, just before we get to our point. But this was a man who was not exercising kulis. This was he was a significant Talmud Chacham. And, for example, he ruled for himself when he was in prison in Russia, and I guess everybody spent some time there. When he was in a work camp in Russia, he ruled for himself that not everything is pikuach nefesh. Being beaten is not pikuach nefesh, etc. And therefore, he was going to keep Shabbos there no matter what. He was not going to work there on Shabbos. And besides that, I'll just give one example of when you hear about the broad things, Shabbos, Kashrus, but even of the fine details of Halacha. He was a teacher. And what he would try to do was, he would try to daven Shachris quietly, unobtrusively, either in a corner or on his way to school or whatever it is, in a way that he wouldn't be noticed. Somehow or the other, he timed it wrong at one point. And he was at a point in davening where you're not allowed to talk when the bell rang and the class was actually supposed to start. And the students filed in. And he decided that he was not going to speak. He couldn't continue davening. All the students were there watching him, waiting for him to start class. And he's at a point in davening where he's not allowed to speak. On the other hand, he can't endanger himself. So he just sat there at the teacher's desk and glared at the students. And they all started squirming and fidgeting and start trying to figure out, is the teacher mad about something? And anything they said to him, he just scowled deeply, shook his head, and for the entire period, he just sat there with his arms folded and glared at them. Until finally, when the period ended, he got up and stalked out of the room. With this display of anger, none of the students could figure out. They all didn't know what to do with themselves. The teacher was obviously very mad about something. They couldn't figure it out. Then he tried to figure out what it was he was mad about. Came back the next day and said that he felt that they hadn't been listening properly, paying proper attention in a lesson the previous week or something like that. This is just an example about the way he lived his life. But a certain culmination of the story was that when he came to Eretz Yisrael, the long story, actually I recommend reading the book. When he came to Eretz Yisrael, this is something mind-boggling. He made the rounds by many of the Rabbanim of the Gedolim of the time. He came with his son to meet Reb Chaim Shmulevitz. Now, what I'm about to say now is so fantastic that it defies imagination. He came with his son to meet Reb Chaim Shmulevitz. He introduced his son to Reb Chaim Shmulevitz as people who had just made it from behind the Iron Curtain to Eretz Yisrael. And he told Reb Chaim Shmulevitz that he learned with his son. His son is proficient in Bava Kama, Bava Metzia, and Bava Basra, in terms of Gemara. And in terms of Shulchan Aruch, he's proficient in all of the sections of Erachayim and Yeredeya. That's half of Shulchan Aruch. Erachayim and Yeredeya. And which is very impressive for a standard yeshiva bacher, if he can really claim proficiency in these areas after learning in yeshiva. And Reb Chaim Shmulevitz burst into tears. Reb Yitzchok Zilber, who was new right off the boat, literally, said that at the time he thought that Reb Chaim Shmulevitz was weeping because of how sad it is that these were the paltry achievements of a boy in Russia, that this was all he was able to learn. That's why he thought Reb Chaim Shmulevitz was weeping. It's astounding. It's astounding. But this is the way this man lived his life in communist Russia, behind the Iron Curtain. This is an obvious example of what we call mesilas nefesh, living with self-sacrifice. Living with self-sacrifice. And this is the subject that I want to discuss now. Now, I want to say in advance that you may wonder, so what am I going to be calling for? Should we all try to reestablish an Iron Curtain and move back there? The glories of, in order to gain the glories of a life of mesilas nefesh? So let's see. But I want to back up a little bit. I want to back up a little bit and let's talk Chanukah. I want to lay down something that's fundamental. It's a little bit intricate. Please bear with me. Try to follow what I'm saying. A little bit intricate, but I think it's fundamental in understanding the nature, the essence of Chanukah. Famously and disappointingly, the halacha is that there is no din, there is no obligation, there's no injunction to make a suda on Chanukah. Shulchan Aruch says that Chanukah parties are not a mitzvah, and the Rama adds that if you sing Shiras Hashpachas, you sing songs of praise to Hashem, you say Divrei Torah, you can turn it into a Sudas Mitzvah. But there is essentially no obligation of having a Suda on Chanukah. What is the celebration of Chanukah? The celebration of Chanukah is reciting Hallel and lighting the menorah. That's the celebration of Chanukah. The celebration of Chanukah is purely spiritual. In contrast, on Purim, there is an absolute obligation to have a suda, and to make it lavish, and to make it merry. So on Chanukah, we see that the celebration is purely spiritual. On Purim, the celebration is physical. And this is a famous question. And the answer is almost also famous. The answer is also famous, but I want to break it down to its details. The famous answer that I think that everybody knows, many know, is given by the Bach, who explains, and it's almost obvious, the answer in a basic way, that since the nature of Chanukah was that it was the spirituality being threatened, and the nace of Chanukah was that spirituality was restored to us, meaning Chanukah was not an anti-Semitic business per se. The Greeks had no problem with the Jewish people. They just wanted the Jewish people living a Greek culture. If you were to drop Torah mitzvahs and adopt the Greek culture, they had no problem with Jews. On the contrary, they welcomed you, they embraced you. Their problem was only the spirituality of the Jewish people. That's what they wanted to do away with. That's what We needed Hashem to restore to us, and therefore the celebration of Hanukkah is spiritual. By contrast, on Purim, the celebration is physical. Why? The answer there also is obvious. The threat there was completely physical. Haman didn't care if you were religious, not religious, keeping Torah mitzvahs, not keeping Torah mitzvahs. You were a Jew, Jewish blood, he wanted you dead. It was a very, very physical business. And therefore, when we were saved, what was saved? We were saved physically. And therefore, the celebration is physical. Celebration is physical. Now that is the Bach explanation stated in a simple way. His explanation is really a bit more intricate than that. And I want to go through his intricate explanation slowly, I hope clearly. He says that both on Hanukkah and Purim, now we're going to move away from Purim for a moment, so we're going to focus just on Hanukkah, because that's our subject now. He says that on Hanukkah, there were really five steps. This is true for Hanukkah and Purim. There were five steps to the story. On Hanukkah, all five steps, there were five steps on the spiritual track. On Purim, there were five steps on the physical track. Now, like I said, let's move our focus over to Hanukkah. It began with, the story did not begin with a threat. It did not begin with oppressors. It began with a sin on our part. The sin was followed by punishment. The punishment was followed by tshuva. The tshuva was followed by a salvation. And the salvation we respond to by instituting a celebration of the salvation. Now let's state that again quickly, five steps, and then let's elaborate. It began with an aveira. That brought about a punishment. The punishment inspired tshuva. Tshuva brought about, resulted in a salvation. And the salvation inspired us to institute a celebration. Okay? Number one, sin, punishment, tshuva, salvation, celebration. Five steps. Okay. What was the sin? What was the sin on Hanukkah? Purim is a little more famous. What was the sin on Hanukkah? The sin on Hanukkah was that shenisrapu midivrei Torah. The Jewish people grew lax in their Torah observance. What does that mean? What this means is that before the Greeks started issuing their decrees, the Jewish people were affected. I don't know precisely what the numbers were, but whatever the case is, Greek culture infiltrated Eretz Yisrael by dint of the fact that the Greeks were now the rulers, and the Jewish people were affected by Greek culture, and it caused a weakening in their Torah observance. As people became exposed to Greek culture, as people began embracing Greek culture to different degrees, as is the case with Western culture, it affected their Yiddishkeit. There were those who dropped it entirely in order to embrace the full lock, stock, and barrel of Greek culture, including all of the pagan gods, etc. And there were those that didn't. There were those who accepted it to different degrees, but they already had a new passion in their life. They already had a new way of life, and that compromised their passion, their dedication to Yiddishkeit. We'll give just one illustration. A gymnasium was built on Har HaBayis, right next door, right adjacent to the Beis HaMikdash. Without getting into all the details, part of the agenda was to try to lure more of the Bnei HaKahuna, more of the Kehanim, into a life of Greek culture. It was actually built by a corrupt Kohen Gadol. a Hellenizer who had gotten the office of Kohen Gadol through a bribery. That was a plague in the second Beit HaMikdash. But whatever the case is, they built this gymnasium where Jewish boys would compete with Greek boys, etc., etc. And what happened? You could have the Kohanim, the young Kohanim, who were training in the Beis HaMikdash, or actually serving the Beis HaMikdash, perhaps to reach that age also, who would go also in their leisure time to this gymnasium to compete, to exercise. Now it can start with, it's a good way to stretch your limbs a little bit. But then it very much started turning into a culture. You wanted to excel. You wanted to prove yourself to your Greek counterparts. You wanted to prove, you could call it Kiddush Hashem even, show that a Kohen can compete in these various sports just as good as any Greek. You want to show the Hellenizers that the Frum can also be cool. Kiddush Hashem, quote unquote. Kiddush Hashem, they went further. They used to compete naked. And it began to be a bit of a problem because it was embarrassing that the Jewish youths, they were circumcised. And that made them stand out from their Greek counterparts. Ooh, Chilul Hashem, again in quotation marks. Chilul Hashem, Jews look weird. That's a Chilul Hashem, right? And therefore, in order once again to make it to Kiddush Hashem, the Jews shouldn't look weird, they would draw the flesh over the place of the milah so that they shouldn't appear circumcised. That's a very, very big misconception. The thought that when a Jew seems different, that itself is a Chilul Hashem. Chilul Hashem, on the contrary, when a Jew is loyally representing his values, that's Kiddush Hashem. Chilul Hashem is when you are not representing your values loyally. But that's a big discussion. It's not for now. But whatever the case is, this created a situation where the young Kohanim, I'm not talking about the ones who dropped it all. I'm trying to picture in our minds those who did not want to drop it. But you know what? The kahuna, the service of the kahuna, the study of the kahuna demanded a lot of energy, a lot of headspace. It was a complicated business. The studies were rigorous. The avodah was rigorous. And in order to really be an optimally functioning kohen, you had to be passionate, energetic. It wasn't a simple business, the avodah and the Beis HaMikdash. But when there were competing agendas, when there were other passions in life, this invariably and inevitably came at the expense of, you just didn't have the same time and energy to put into the avodah of the Beis HaMikdash. You cut corners. Okay, so some aspects of the avodah were done a little bit more b'dieved. They weren't done with the same alacrity. They weren't done with the same precision. You weren't necessarily as well-versed, as proficient in the fine details of all the halachas. And in general, your enthusiasm was a little more damp. It was a little more cooled because of other passions that you had in your life. And therefore, in general, I'm using the kahuna as an example, but in general, there began to be a certain weakening, a certain relaxation of the standards, a certain relaxation of the enthusiasm. And of course, this was to many degrees, just like you see with Yiddishkeit today when it competes with Western culture, which is really a descendant, probably even a close descendant of Greek culture. And there was a weakening to different degrees. This is the Avera that the Bach is talking about. And that brought about a punishment. What that meant was as follows. We'll say it in a simple way, and then we'll break it down again, trying to put it into realistic terms. Hashem said, you're losing your enthusiasm. You're becoming a Jew who just kind of like, how do you say, pays lip service. You punch your card. You're holding on to things in a basic way. But I have lost your passion. I've lost your enthusiasm. It's not dedicated to me anymore. Your dedication is not mine anymore. So you know what Hashem said? I'll just take it all away. I don't need your tevis. If you don't want to live a life dedicated to me, if you don't want to live a life in my passionate service, if you want to live a life that's just cool, you kind of pay token service to it, so you know what? I'm just going to take it all away. Forget it. The Greeks came along and said, forget it. No more Shabbos. No more teaching Torah. No more Mila. Forget it all. And what happened now? So this is stage number two. Okay, we talked about the sin. Stage number two is the punishment. This is the punishment, right? And what happened now? Now, all of a sudden, the Jew was faced with a choice. Either you said, and the following, this is one possibility of how you could have responded, but I'm giving that possibility two versions. Either you could have said, okay, look, there's no way to do it. They're going to kill us. Shame, but what can we do? Or there was even another way of saying it. Well, Aynes Rachmana Patre, right? The din is that if a person is unable to, there's an Aynes, Pikuach Nefesh, even though it was a Shema, let's not get into that right now. I can't, I'm off the hook. Now I can really just dedicate my life to Greek culture. And therefore, you had two choices. Either you dropped it all, in one of the two ways that we described, whether reluctantly, whether sadly, whether enthusiastically, you drop it all. Or you say, no way, I am not going to drop it all. I'm going to keep it all. How are you going to keep it all? They're going to kill you. You won't live till the night. There's only one way to do it. You had to move out to the caves. You had to move into hiding. You had to leave the comfort of your home with your small children. Take the whole family and move into deep, dark caves. I don't have that much experience with caves. I have a little bit just in order to picture what it must have been like. My experience with caves, if you're familiar, is the Bat Cave. The Bat Cave outside of Beit Shemesh. Now forget the bats. Not every cave has so many bats in it, but it just gives you an experience of what it really means to live in a cave. Have you been there? I don't know if you've been there, but it's a very beautiful, it's an ideal trail to do with the kids. It's a light trail. It works for young kids. It's nice and challenging for that young age, but it's not overkill. It's a great hike. But at the end of the hike is a bat cave, a big cave, which is populated by hundreds or thousands of bats. And that's the attraction that you go in. Don't worry about it, by the way. They're very high up on the ceiling. You're not going to come into contact with the bats. But I'm setting the bats aside for a moment. I'm just saying that you go into this cave. It could be a nice, hot summer day, whatever it is. You go into this cave and you start going down deeper in. And it is dark and moist. Whatever you touch is slimy. Whatever you touch is slimy. You don't want to slip there, or you're walking on a wooden walkway, but whatever it is, it's all moist. Any of the rocks are slimy. And as you go in, it's really very, very dark. You have to bring your own flashlight along with you if you want to see what's going on. And I'm talking in the middle of the day. There's daylight. The daylight penetrates to the very beginning of the cave. But as you move deeper in and you go deeper and lower and you're walking along this walkway, kind of groping your way around and shining your flashlight in front of you. And that's a cave. You moved in there with your family. And it might sound romantic. It might sound adventurous until you think about it. And you think about, okay, you've gotten there, very exciting. And then it's time to put the kids to bed. You wake up in the morning. What's for breakfast? I have to figure out how to procure food from outside the cave without risking yourself. And then there's lunch, and then there's supper for another day, and another day, and another day. And that's what you need to do if you want to keep Shabbos. All of a sudden, a situation was created, and here is really the point. Here is really the point that the Bach is making. Hashem said, you want to live a life of lackadaisical Judaism? You want to live a life where you're engaged in all kinds of other things, where your passion, your enthusiasm is divided. I get a small share, Hashem says, and you give a lot of it to this, and you give a lot of it to that. And you'll keep keeping Shabbos in a rote kind of way. Hashem says, I'd rather take it all away from you. And now, if you want to do it, all the mitzvahs that used to be very simple, relatively simple, I'll say. Okay, for us, keeping Shabbos today, relatively simple. If you want to do it now, you have to do it with intense dedication. You have to do it with extreme self-sacrifice. In order to keep Shabbos now, you're going to have to do it with extreme self-sacrifice. All of a sudden, Hashem says, you want to keep mitzvahs in a basic way? You're really going to have to be a diehard. You're going to have to be a real diehard in order to keep mitzvahs in a basic way. Who's going to do it? You want to keep Shabbos in a basic way? You want to teach your children Torah at all rather than just completely drop it? Move out to the caves. Live in danger. You and your family. Live in fear in order to continue being a basic Shema Torah mitzvah. And all of a sudden, the simplest of mitzvahs had to be performed, again, with great dedication. This took great dedication. This took great sacrifice. And this was the tshuva. This was the tshuva. We did tshuva for the fact that our dedication was compromised, our dedication was dampened by showing how we're going to go all the way now. We're going to be diehards in order to continue to keep Hashem's Torah. And this was the tshuva that Hashem was waiting for. And we fought against all odds. We fought doggedly, right? We had ragtag groups of yeshiva men attacking units of the greatest army in the world with all of their Hellenizer lackeys. And we fought, we spilled our blood, and we exercised extreme self-sacrifice in order to keep Hashem's Torah. And Hashem said, if so, I am going to provide you with that miraculous salvation. And this is where we got the Nes of Chanukah. This is where we got the Nes of Chanukah. So, Hashem gave us that Nes. And therefore, we celebrate. How do we celebrate? Hashem gave us back. He said, you showed your dedication. You showed your self-sacrifice. You showed that you are a diehard servant of mine. If so, I'm going to give it back to you. I'm going to give it back to you. And we were restored via Avodah. This is the gift that Hashem gave us back. Now, when you get a gift, what's the most basic way of expressing your gratitude? Even before saying thank you. What would you want to see even from a 1.5-year-old child who gets a gift? You want to see him playing with it. Give him a gift. You want to see him enjoying it. So we tell Hashem, you know how we're going to celebrate this gift? You gave us back the ability to keep Torah and mitzvahs because of our self-sacrifice. The way we are going to celebrate it is through spirituality. We're going to add a mitzvah. We're going to recite Hallel. This is how we show Hashem how grateful we are to have the ability to engage in our Ruchnius. But here I want to come back to the point. What was the lesson that was being conveyed? And this is something that we want to remember. We don't want to forget. What was the lesson that was being conveyed? Hashem is telling us, and this really, if you think about it, we've been learning for all these months, Chavis Halvavis. The message of the Chavis Halvavis the whole time is that the essence of Judaism is not to punch your card. It's not to keep your nose clean. It's not to make sure you're keeping to a basic level of Shmiras Torah mitzvahs. That's not what Hashem wants of us. Hashem wants your heart. Hashem wants your dedication. He wants your closeness. He wants your passion. This is what Hashem wants from us. And this is what is expressed through the Mesirus Nefesh. I'd rather leave all the comforts of my home and go out to a cave in order to retain my relationship with Hashem. So this is the message. This is in a large way, this is the lesson that we were taught on Chanukah. Hashem wants to see a life of fire, right? Fire, like the Hanukkah candles. Hashem wants to see a life of intense dedication. Hashem wants our mesius nefesh. He wants our sacrifice. And here we come to our point. So, we're all excited. We're ready to move out to the caves. We're ready to move out to the caves. Just there's a little bit of a problem. There's no need to do so. You can keep Shabbos at home. You can make Shabbos very comfortable, very gishmak. And you don't need to be Maisa Nefesh. You can teach your children Torah and you can learn Torah without having to move out to the caves and without risking your lives, Baruch Hashem, in our time now. So what can we do? We want to practice the Mesirus Nefesh that we saw so glorified back then, that we saw Hashem showed how much he cherished. How are we going to do that now? And the answer is, and here's the big answer. This is really the big answer. You have to understand, I'll approach it this way. So Rabbi Victor Miller would express it like this. We want to find the Mesirus Nefesh in our lives of comfort. In other words, what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is, keeping Shabbos doesn't demand self-sacrifice. But you know what? Where are the areas where I can express more passion, more dedication? And this is something of the challenge. When keeping Torah mitzvahs in a basic way is easy, we have to find within ourselves where can we apply more dedication, more enthusiasm, more passion. Whether it's in tackling areas of Avodas Hashem that are challenges for us, we might have to move out to a cave. But perhaps I have a relationship with somebody that really needs improvement. Perhaps I have somebody in my life that provokes me on a regular basis, and I always lose myself with this person. I don't relate to this person the way I should, and I know it. You know what? Here's the place of self-sacrifice. Sometimes the Mesirus Nefesh is not necessarily moving out to a cave, but you know what? Perhaps it is in holding back when I'm provoked, or in being good and nice when I really, really don't feel like it. Doesn't necessarily feel as romantic, as exciting, as adventurous as moving out to a cave. But you know what? This is the same sort of Mesirus Nefesh that Hashem wants. Or to decide, I'm tired now. I don't really have the koyach for davening, but I'm going to put in a tefillah of Mesirus Nefesh anyways. And I'm also going to try to imbue more enthusiasm into it. I'm going to go out of my way to step up the level of my kashrus observance, whether it's an issue of financial cost, whether it's an issue of inconvenience. There are all kinds of ways in our comfortable lives that we can find to express more dedication, more passion for Hashem. Like I said, be it in the realm of Bein Adam L'Chaveroi, be it in the realm of self-control, be it in the realm of giving to others, be it in the realm of tefillah, be it in the realm of halacha in various areas. We all have the areas where, yes, we can exercise self-sacrifice. And here, I come back to where I started saying, where Rabbi Victor Miller says, he says that it's like the Mesirus Yesharim says. Mesirus Yesharim says that every situation of life provides nisayon, provides us with tests. Or we translate that into the way it really ought to be said, provides us with opportunity. A test, a nisayon, is not something negative. When we're tested, what it really is it's an opportunity for our growth. It's an opportunity for us to make ourselves greater. It's an opportunity for us to go closer to Hashem by showing our dedication for Him. Now, everything is a nisayon. Of course, tribulation is a nisayon. Oppression is a nisayon. But you know what? The other side of the coin is that comfort and leisure is a nisayon as well. Being in a situation where keeping Torah and mitzvahs is relatively easy, that's a nisayon also. The nisayon there is the other side of the coin. Will you be capable of finding in yourself, of drawing out for you, from yourself, the resolve not to just smooth along on to just drive along on autopilot on easy street, but there is always room to step up the Mesirus Nefesh and to find where I can put more into, give more of myself into my Shmiras Torah mitzvahs, into my relationship with Hashem, into my closeness with Hashem. And this is where we're being asked for it. So Rabbi Moshe Arieli in the Mir Yeshiva would say when he would begin his shiur, he had his shiur at regular time on Hanukkah. Sometimes that itself is a chiddush when you hear that, you know, but there's a regular schedule in yeshiva on Hanukkah. Hanukkah is a time for vacation. You know what? It's really the other way around. Hanukkah is a time for extra dedication. And perhaps if there's any benefit to the time that there's an attitude, even in yeshivas, that there should be vacation going on now, it should be a vacation state. Maybe on the contrary, it's in order to provide that opportunity. Can you even on Hanukkah maintain the regular schedule? Can you even on Hanukkah give it the full learning schedule? There's a time for everything. You can find the time. It actually says in Halacha that if you do want to make Hanukkah parties, do it without it coming at the expense of your learning. And that's what they do in the yeshivas. All the yeshivas have their time for the Hanukkah Mesiba. But I'm using this as an example. I understand that I'm talking to women. This isn't relevant per se. But as an example, it certainly is.
Sorry, Rabbi, no sound.
We can't hear you, Rabbi Jacobson.
Still no sound. Sorry. The pros and cons of modern technology. No, can't hear you.
Sorry, no sound.
Sorry about the frustration. Still nothing, unfortunately, still nothing.
No, Hadassah, it makes no difference. We can't hear. Makes no difference on the phone or on the computer.